Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nimix, your host and Director of External Affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's episode sponsor, Advocate Capital. Advocate is passionate about helping plaintiffs' attorneys get better results for clients, mainly through their AdvoTrack case expense funding service. It allows firms to track case expenses and recover borrowing costs, which makes the net cost of borrowing zero on cases they win. Learn more at advocatecapital.com. My guest today is Coleman Cowan. He is the leader of the litigation department at the law offices of James Scott Farron, and during his career, he has won millions in jury awards for his clients. He's also won a slew of awards outside the courtroom, including two Emmys, the Edward R. Murrow, a Gracie, a Peabody, and a Polk. He accumulated these during a break he took from his legal career to become a journalist, after a brush with death made him decide he wanted to live and not merely exist. Coleman's work as a producer for 60 Minutes and CBS News took him to some of the most dangerous places in the world and allowed him access to some of the world's most fascinating newsmakers. He'll be presenting at NCAJ's Strategy Summit about the lessons learned from his days as a journalist and how he uses them to manage stress and anxiety. Strategy Summit is coming up on October 23rd and 24th at the Durham Convention Center. You can learn more about the tremendous lineup of speakers we have waiting for you at this event and register at ncaj.com/strategy-summit-2025. Coleman, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Amber. Glad to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Great. So let's start at the beginning. You had been practicing law for a while when you decided that you needed a career change. Tell me about the events that led up to that decision.
Yeah. So, Amber, you're right. I had been practicing for about 10 years when I decided to make the change that took me on this journey. And that decision actually started a few years earlier when two pretty seminal events happened in my life. And rather ironically, they happened within a few hours of each other and in the same place. In February of 1999, I was sitting in the parking lot of a doctor's deposition waiting to go inside and take this doctor's deposition. And I had the realization that all the hard work that I put in law school and as a young associate at this big law firm, the reward for all that work was just going to be more hard work. And that was weighing pretty heavily on my mind as I walked into this deposition. And then walking out of the deposition a few hours later, I was shot. A random mugging, the other attorney and I were shot. This was in Durham, and you can imagine that caused me to reevaluate the priorities in my life. And over time, one of those priorities was not continuing to do more hard work just for hard work's sake. So I decided I needed to make a change, and that's what launched this journey that took me up to New York eventually and then all around the world.
So it was a random shooting. It had nothing to do with the legal work that you were doing.
Yeah. And it's funny that that's everybody's assumption that I was working on some really interesting, high profile, contentious case. But no, it was completely random. The police thought it was a gang initiation. We were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And even when I saw this kid come up to us and even when I saw the gun come out, I didn't expect that he was just going to start shooting. But he did, and I'm obviously okay. I'm here. And the other attorney, John Watson, out of Oxford, he was okay too. We both recovered, but it had a major, major impact on my life.
So you had already been thinking that maybe there was more to life than the litigation work that you were doing at the time, and this was like sort of an exclamation point on those thoughts.
Yeah, you'd like to think you don't quite need the reminder of that that I got, but it was a wake-up call, and it just made me reassess what was important to me at that time, and some things are still important to me now, but just the way I was working and how much I was working and how committed I was just was not healthy and was not sustainable long-term, and I didn't want to be at the ripe old age of 55, which I am today, you know, dying of a heart attack from stress or whatever, leading an unhappy life. So I just decided I needed to make a change. At the time, I had no idea what that change needed to be other than I just needed to stop doing what I was doing.
And so was it a pretty typical litigation career? You're spending like 50, 60 hours a week, like nose to the grindstone, billable hours kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were highly successful and making a lot of money. And
Yeah. If you look at that barometer of success, which I would encourage folks not to, but yeah, it was successful in that regard. I started out as a defense attorney for what was then a large Southeastern regional law firm. They're now an international firm. I switched sides to actually try cases and work with real people, and that was enjoyable, but I was still just working all the time and had a lot of success. And from the outside looking in, I think it looked very different from what my experience was day to day.
So the obvious next step after this sort of epiphany was journalism.
Well, that's what I eventually landed on. Again, when I left, after I got over everybody telling me I was making a monumentally foolish decision, I had to figure out what I wanted to do. And I landed on journalism because one of the reasons why I stepped away from my legal practice was I was working so much and just around the clock and traveling all over the country that I felt completely detached from what was going on in the world. And so I thought, what better way to become in tune with what was going on in the world than to make that my job? The problem with that was I had absolutely no experience at all. I had never even written for my high school newspaper, but I had this grand scheme that I was going to become Tom Wolfe and write for Rolling Stone and write all these interesting music profiles and then start writing books on my own. So that kernel of an idea is what led me to journalism. And then one thing led to another. And I just had a series of being in the right place at the right time, talking to the right person, and fantastic opportunity opens up for me.
Okay. And so your colleagues in the legal field were aghast, stunned, dismayed.
Yeah, that's not an understatement at all. My partners told me I was crazy. My law professors that I'm still very close to told me I was crazy. The federal judge I worked for told me I was crazy. They put it more diplomatically. Judges told me I was crazy. Everybody told me, Coleman, this is a monumentally foolish decision. You're walking away from a good career path that is laid out in front of you. You know, even that little voice in my head said, you know what? You might just be crazy for doing this. But what got me past all that were three very important voices that told me I was not crazy. One was my then girlfriend, now wife, Angie, and the other two were my parents. And I always remember this conversation, and especially hearing my dad tell me, yeah, Coleman, I've spent my life, your life, raising you to think critically for yourself and make good decisions. And after he heard and my mom heard what I was experiencing, what I was thinking about, and the changes I was thinking about, you know, they both looked at me and said, I think you're making a smart decision. And, you know, of all the voices that said I was crazy, the two voices from my parents and the one from my then girlfriend, now wife, she's always much more reasonable and smarter than me. But that was the first time I figured that out. But those were all more important voices for me to hear than everybody else.
And that's even more remarkable for everyone who knows who your father was. He was an attorney, and that was your sort of role model as you became an attorney, right?
Exactly. And I approached that conversation with more than a little bit of trepidation, because we were always close when he was alive, and his thoughts on things and what he said to me were always just critically important. And he was sort of my North Star for really everything in my life, both professionally and personally. And yet there was the added factor too of I was, I don't know, or am, third, fourth, fifth generation Cowan lawyer. My dad was a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer. His father and brother were lawyers. In my office at home, I have North Carolina law books going back and journals going back 150 years. So that was running through my mind too, that I was getting ready to break this series of events that had been going on for a century and a half. But, you know, it was the right decision for me.
Not too many Rolling Stone journalists in the family then.
No. I would have been the first. And unfortunately, the Cowans are still over in that category. I did meet Jan Wenner, and I did ask him for a job. And he did say, yeah, talk to my managing editor. And it went exactly where Jan planned it to go, which was nowhere. But, you know, things turned out okay for me regardless.
Well, it's interesting to me that as someone who had a legal degree, that when you decided to move into journalism, you didn't go straight to grad school. You went to work as a journalist, which is, you know, most folks who have a grad degree tend to, maybe this is just my supposition, would tend to go get a grad degree and then go do the work. What made you do that in the opposite order?
Well, I wanted to make sure that this grand plan that I had and this grand idea I had were actually a good plan and a good idea. So again, with no experience, I talked my way into Business Week magazine in Atlanta. This was 2005, and the first assignment that they sent me on was to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And it was just an absolutely amazing experience, and it confirmed for me that I was on to something pretty special. Business writing is not what I wanted to do. It was exciting. The stories that I got to work on, and you know, it was pretty cool seeing your name in print for the first time and you know every time, really. But I needed to learn how to become a good writer and a good journalist and a good storyteller. And that's what took me to New York and Columbia, to the Graduate School of Journalism there.
Right. And so while you're at Columbia, 60 Minutes picks up your master's project.
Again, another in the series of Right Place, Right Time, talking to the right person, because at the time, this was the early 2000s, the journalism school there was split. You were either on the print track or the broadcast track. And again, remember, I wanted to write for Rolling Stone. That's a print publication. So I was all about long-form print journalism and knew nothing about television at all. But one of my good friends in the investigative program was my opposite. He wanted to do TV. He got an entry-level job at 60 Minutes after we graduated. And one of the beautiful things about 60 Minutes is anybody and everybody can pitch stories, and you're encouraged to pitch stories. And he pitched my master's project, and they picked it up. And so when this grand plan with Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone didn't work out, I found myself interviewing for a job at 60 Minutes, which turned out okay.
Wow. What was the story that he pitched?
So I wrote my master's project on a story about how the New York Police Department at the time stored, maintained, and either retrieved or didn't retrieve criminal evidence, decades of criminal evidence. And if you think about the New York City Police Department, there's five boroughs, there's 8 million people, lots of crime, lots of evidence that needs to be retained and maintained, and you need to know where it is. And I read a story in the New York Times by a journalist named Jim Dwyer. I mentioned his name because he was pretty influential to me. He wrote a story about a man named Alan Newton, who was freed from prison after like more than 20 years in jail for a rape he was convicted of in the early 1980s, which he had always protested his innocence. And for the past 15 years, he had been trying to get the rape kit from his case tested for DNA, because again, he was maintaining his innocence. He was convicted before there was DNA testing. And for 15 years, the police department told Alan Newton, we can't find the rape kit. And I mean, just think about that. The key to his innocence is somewhere buried in some huge warehouse in New York City, and the police can't find it. And they couldn't find it because the way they used to keep track of all the evidence was a paper voucher system, carbon copy system. And pieces of paper were filed away in filing cabinets. And if the voucher got lost or dropped or misplaced, you couldn't find whatever you were looking for. And eventually, somebody found the rape kit in Alan Newton's case buried in a barrel in the back of a warehouse in Queens. And it was tested, and lo and behold, he was proven innocent. And I read that, and I thought, I can't believe that the police department in New York is storing and retaining evidence that way. So that was my project, and that's what got picked up by 60 Minutes.
Wow. And from there, you were a 60 Minutes producer.
Well, it wasn't quite that smooth of a path. From there, I was a 60 Minutes broadcast associate, which meant that I was doing research and what I refer to as chasing tape, going to get archival footage to fill in as B-roll in the stories. But eventually, some of the producers and some of the correspondents realized that, hey, maybe this kid Cowan, who's a broadcast associate, maybe he can do something a little bit more. So over a few years, fortunately, things worked out and I became an associate producer and then worked my way up to producing stories there for everybody from Leslie Stahl, Scott Pelley, and I ended my career as one of Steve Cross' producers.
Wow. So I don't know how many stories you must have produced. Was it in the like dozens, hundreds, or?
It's in the dozens because of how much work is involved in each one. Each season, I was responsible for about four or five stories to produce for, you know, in the end, it was Steve Croft. And so you immerse yourself in those stories and become an expert for however long, 6 months, 8 months, you know, sometimes a year or more, depending on what the story is.
And some of those stories took you to incredibly, like, physically perilous places, right?
Yeah, they did. And I guess at the time, and as I reflect on many of the places that I found myself, I benefited from being a bit naive about all the dangers that we faced at the time. And it was only when we extracted from the situation that I really dawned on me how dangerous some of these places were. I saw more dead bodies and guns in Mexico and actually on the south side of Chicago. I saw in many other places. I was in Afghanistan in 2009 at a forward operating base, shooting a story on a task force that was searching for IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. Like, their job was to go find the bombs, and our job was to be with them when they found the bombs. And they found them. We were all fine and safe, but we had some interesting journeys through the backcountry of Afghanistan that, you know, I'll never forget. And it's one of the many places that I found myself around the world where I thought, you know, I wouldn't be here but for this job, which was fantastic.
And you were in Russia with Alexei Navalny, correct?
Yeah, that's one of the other places I think about when I think, you know, we were just in a very dangerous situation. I perhaps didn't realize it at the time. I spent a couple weeks with Alexei Navalny in the spring of 2017 when he was running for president against Vladimir Putin. We were with him in Moscow and out in the country in Russia as he campaigned and as he and we were followed by the FSB, what used to be the KGB. Many times we saw them, many times we didn't. There was one time our picture ended up on the front page of a newspaper in Penza, and we were each numbered and identified as CIA spies working with Alexei Navalny. I thought that was kind of humorous when I sent it to my wife. She did not see the humor in that.
I can imagine that wouldn't strike me as funny.
Yeah.
Either. So it was a very different kind of stress than you had experienced as a very hardworking litigation attorney, I'm guessing.
Yeah, there was plenty of stress there, but there's stress everywhere in whatever people do. And I learned that it's all relative. There were other producers at 60 Minutes that got really, really stressed going into a screening for their story. And I thought to myself, you know, this is not that stressful. Like, these people want your story to do well. It's not like arguing before the Supreme Court or arguing a case where you've got opposing counsel and they're trying to tear down everything you're doing. In the broadcast room, like, we're all working towards the same goal, but like, stress was relative, but there was plenty of stress involved in what I did there.
Mm-hmm. And you also just had the stress of, if you weren't personally in peril, there was the stress of dealing with very famous people, with people who were in stressful situations, that kind of pressure. Like, what were some of those kind of stories that you remember as being very intense?
So I joke with people, but there's some truth to this. Some of the more difficult people I had to deal with in my career there were the folks at 60 Minutes. There were a lot of big egos on the ninth floor at 555 West 57th Street, you know, for good reason. This is the top of broadcast journalism. But there were some big egos that we had to navigate around. But the benefit of what we were able to do is we spend a lot of time immersed in the story. So the folks that we're working with, that we're interviewing, By the time they sit in front of a camera, I've spent weeks, if not months, talking to them and building up trust and getting access. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how that turns out sometimes. I remember we did a story on Dabo Swinney, fortuitously, the season that he won his first championship in 2016. But man, we had to negotiate for months with the press officer there just to get access to Dabo and to tell the story. And we sat down for the interview and his handler told me, Coleman, you got 30 minutes for this. And so I rearranged all the questions to front load everything. And then 3 hours later, Dabo's still telling us stories. Like, he had the greatest time. So you find yourself in funny circumstances that tend to work out. Another story that I'd tell about a difficult situation in a story, we were shooting a story on a man named Billy Walters, who's a big sports gambler out in Las Vegas. And I'd spent a long time setting up this shoot at a sports book in Las Vegas at the M. And we were going to shoot in the middle of the sports book on the first Sunday of the NFL season that year. And we had it all lined up. And I showed up an hour or two early before the shoot. And the guy I've been working with to set everything up at the sports book, he was the head of the sports book. He could make anything happen. He pulled me aside and he said, Coleman, we got a problem. I was like, what are you talking about? We've been working on this, everything set up. What kind of problem do we have? And he said, Floyd's here. And I looked at him and I said, so? I don't care if Floyd's here. Like, we've set this up. Everybody's coming in. We need that space. And he said, you don't understand. And I said, well, okay, let me go talk to Floyd. And he said, he looked at me and he kind of smiled and he said, okay. And we walked up and Floyd was Floyd Mayweather Jr. And Floyd Mayweather Jr. didn't want to move for anybody until our correspondent, Laura Logan, showed up. And all of a sudden, he wanted to do anything he could do to help us out. So Floyd and I became friends. He showed me all the money he won that day. We got to shoot the interview where we wanted to, but it was kind of funny. Once it dawned on me who Floyd was, and I now needed to go talk to Floyd and ask him, can you move so we can do some business here?
So a lot of life lessons that you're not going to learn inside the courtroom on how to make things happen in the world of journalism.
Yeah, well, but some important life lessons that how to make friends with people, gain their trust, and persuade them to do something good for you.
Yeah, I'm not an attorney, but I am a former journalist, and I've been writing about and working with attorneys for about 15 years now. And that whole, like, trust and storytelling are two components that are really, I've found, very much, you know, you can't be a good lawyer or a good journalist without being able to get people to believe what you're saying and being able to tell their stories, you know, so.
Right. We spent a lot of time building up that trust, and I had lots of people that were not happy with the story that we told Sunday at 7 o'clock, but none of them ever told me, I was shocked. I didn't understand. You told me one thing and I saw something else. Everybody knew what we were doing and weren't surprising. Many weren't happy, but they weren't surprised.
So with your presentation coming up at Strategy Summit, you're going to be talking about what your experiences can teach us about managing stress and anxiety. So what are just a few of the lessons from your years in journalism? What did you learn about managing stress and anxiety, and how do they apply to the work you do now as a litigator?
So I sort of backed into all this once I came back and started trying cases again, and all that stress and anxiety that had been absent for 10 or 12 years came flooding back. And I found myself drawing on experiences and lessons I learned from people that I met, some really smart and interesting people that I met while I was reporting stories from all over the world. And what I do in this presentation is I basically tell stories about people that I met and experiences that I had and what they had gone through, and talk about the lessons that I extracted from them. Lessons like being a good writer, being a good storyteller, be willing to take risks, don't be afraid to fail, never stop learning. Hopefully I tell these in a somewhat interesting way, because I tell them through other people that I met and that helped me understand these lessons. You know, people at 60 Minutes like Steve Croft or Scott Pelley, other people that I met just out reporting, Alexei Navalny, folks like James Hetfield and Duff McKagan. Those names may be familiar to some of your audience here. But just interesting things that I learned and lessons that I drew on that helped me in what I do today.
Well, that sounds like it would be definitely worth trending out for. I'm so glad that you're going to be part of the program.
Well, looking forward to it.
Great, great. And thank you for sharing some stories with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed our conversation.
Coleman Cowan will be presenting at NCAJ's Strategy Summit on October 23rd at the Durham Convention Center. To Live, Not Exist, What Our Experiences Can Teach Us About Managing Stress and Anxiety. You can learn more and register at ncaj.com/strategysummit2025. Before we go, I would like to thank our Circle of Leadership program sponsors, Abrams & Abrams, Bryson Harris Suchi DeMay, Henson Furst, the law offices of James Scott Farron, the law offices of John McCabe, Whitley Law Firm, Brown Moore & Associates, Edwards Kirby, Johnson & Groninger, DeMayo Law Offices, the law offices of Wallace & Graham, Horton & Mendez Injury Attorneys, Kuntz & Smith, the law offices of Jason E. Taylor, the Sumwalt Group, Elrod Pope, and Orndorff Law Firm. These firms are supporting NCAJ's mission as founding members of the Circle of Leadership at the Gemstone level. Find out how your firm can join the Circle of Leadership at ncaj.com/circle. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.